Funding for the Hinckley Report is made possible in part by Merit Medical and by contributions to PBS Utah from viewers like you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Hinckley Report, your weekly political roundup. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and leave us a 5-star review.
On this episode of the Hinckley Report, as the dust settles from the 2025 legislative session, what major themes emerged? Who are the winners and the losers? What priorities made it to the finish line? And what were the major compromises?
Good evening, and welcome to the Hinckley Report. I'm Jason Perry, director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Covering the week, we have Representative Hong Nguyen, a Democrat from Salt Lake County and a member of the PBS Utah Advisory Board. Representative Jefferson Moss, a Republican from Utah County and House Majority Leader. And Max Roth, anchor with Fox 13 News. Thank you for being with us. We're going to break down the legislative session a little bit. We had, it's a little bit in the rearview mirror, a lot of things still happening. We understand the bills that were passed, but also some actions that might be coming. But I want to start first with just how many bills you all talked about. It was a big number right there. Representative Moss, let's talk about this for a minute, because you broke one record this session, 959 bills introduced. That was a record, although it was not a record in the number of bills passed, 582, although it was close. Talk about that for a minute. That's a lot of bills.
Yeah, we hear that every session, and every representative comes up with some great ideas, maybe sometimes not the greatest ideas, but to them they're the greatest ideas, and they want to come and represent their districts or certain perspectives. And of course, we allow that, right? There's no specific way that we say, there's no limit on the number of bills. We've tried to do some things over the last couple of years to minimize that, you get a certain amount of priority bills and trying to say, let's focus on those bills.
Well, explain what that means, because you have priorities of leadership individually.
Yeah, so each individual representative, because we have a lot of representatives and a limited amount of staff, and there's only so much that they can do, especially if they wait later into, as we get into the session. Our alleged staff has a lot of bills that they're working on. And so we try to help them to prioritize what are the most important things for them to make sure that those do get drafted. So we make sure those are their first priority. But we also know that a lot of legislators like to run a lot of bills. What we've tried to do in the last couple of years to hopefully try to minimize that is we've even tried to bring their topics where we get a lot of interest, elections, whatever those things might be, trying to bring those groups together to say, can you work together? Can you try to maybe bring some of these bills into one bill, right? There's a lot of discussions like that we try to do. But yeah, it's always a challenge with the number of bills that we have.
I would love to hear the perspective from Representative Nguyen about how overwhelming it must be. When I watch as a reporter the votes, the bills come up so quickly, and then you have to vote within minutes, and these are complex topics. It must just come at you.
How have you handled this? Because this is quite the introduction.
It's been quite the introduction. And a lot of seasoned lawmakers says this is one of the toughest legislative sessions that they've ever had. So yay for all us freshmen who came in, right? When we have that many bills come on that quickly, it is not realistic to be able to read thoroughly all of the bills. So we're just looking at the highlights of these bills. And then on top of that, it reduces the amount of debate time and community input that we get when you have so many bills coming. This year, we passed, last year actually, we passed 591 bills, which is a record ever in the state history. This year, we passed 9 bills less than last year's record. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of bills to pass. The ability for all these lawmakers to be able to read these bills, understand it, get the input from our constituents, from subject matter experts, is just not realistic. So I don't think it does a service to the state of Utah when we're passing so many bills like this.
Mm-hmm. Max, the governor weighed in on this very issue. It was an interesting comment from him. He called on the legislature to ratchet down, those are his words, ratchet down the number of bills so we can have more process and get better outcomes. That's something he's saying. It's a little bit what Representative was just talking about as well. Talk about that a little bit, because the argument is it might be hampering the amount of time our legislators have to talk about specific bills.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think I was looking at some of the research I think that the Hinckley Institute did, which said that each bill gets a an average debate time of 11 minutes. 11 minutes is not a lot of time. You think about it took me three times that this morning to drive here. And over that course of time to have laws debated and decided I can't imagine that there's a whole lot of thoroughness going on. It must help to have super majorities because then things go a lot smoother from that perspective.
It's interesting. This is Professor Adam Brown at BYU that keeps a running tally of these things. You can go look at that as well. But Representative Moss, one of the interesting dynamics of the Utah legislature is you have a single subject rule. Mm-hmm. Some people talk about this a little bit. You cannot do multiple issues in one bill, which may be causing you to have three when you would have preferred to have one.
Yeah, and there's discussion about whether or not we move away from that. The challenge, of course, is if you start to do these omnibus bills, then you get all sorts of subjects that are not aligned in the same bill. And that's when I think you do get some confusion around what is this bill really doing. But it does create some challenges, right? We can only do the single bill, and that's, maybe something we could look at. I do want to add, though, a lot of the debate and discussion is in those committees. It's in the interim. We're having a lot of discussions before that. We, as leadership in our House, also have said we want to see less bills. We're all, we will say that all the time, but at the end of the day, each of our members, gets the right to be able to open the number of bills they do. The other thing is we have a lot of bills that really are not complicated bills. They're cleanup bills. We do a lot of those, and so sometimes you'll see that and think, well, they're not really been debating. Well, it went through the committee unanimous. People all felt good about it. So there's not really a need to have those long discussions.
That happens the better part of the session, but something that was new to me that happened at the end of the session is when there's a motion to suspend all rules, and within the last couple of days of session, we are passing bills that did not get committee hearing, did not get proper input, mm-hmm. and does not have time for proper debate on the floor. So that's where my concern comes in when we are passing so many bills and we suspend motion of all rules and we don't have committee hearings, so we can actually really dig deep on some of those bills.
She's right. At the very end, they do, both sides do suspension of the rules, and it's both Republican Democrat bills on both sides that haven't had the opportunity to get both hearings. We scrutinize those as they come over. We're both trying to look at them. But I do think there is a concern about that. When they don't get that second hearing, that does become a challenge. But that's something that both the House and Senate have agreed to, and we try to limit that, but it's just suspension of that second committee.
Mm-hmm. You certainly kept all of us busy. Let's get to a couple of these bills. Max, you're watching so closely some of these themes. Mm-hmm. The thing that everyone was talking about, even at the heart of these bills, was the budget itself. It was still a $30.8 billion budget, mm-hmm. but it was not the amount that people had been hoping. Talk about some of the big issues in your reporting that seemed to sort of catch the attention of Utahns, the ones that did get funded and maybe something that didn't.
Well, a lot of the funding conversation was around, there was a lot of conversation around education and higher education specifically. And that's something that I think the public is going to see play out now. Those who have students in Utah colleges, a lot of folks are going to see, a lot of folks will agree that we need more technical education and more emphasis on that. But then, the flagship university where we're sitting right now, the University of Utah, is more of an institution that is research, liberal arts, those sorts of things, and that is going to suffer because of the emphasis on technical education. And so that was a big budget issue that I was focused on specifically. Tax cuts, they tend to be popular. It's a rather incremental change to the income tax cut from 4.455% to 4.5%, and how big a difference that makes in a person's life compared to what it takes from the state budget, I think is a big question.
Representative Moss, that higher education was a big one. I know I'm connected to it here, but it was a 10% cut and a reallocation, so it can stay with the university. Talk about the backroom discussions about this and what the hope is for higher education, and tie into this great point from Max about technical education.
Yeah, so I would say it was not backroom. This was very openly discussed through the interim. There's a lot of conversation around how do we make sure that higher education is offering the programs that are the most relevant today, right? We create programs and they go on indefinitely. And over time, there's things that become less relevant for that period. And so looking and saying, what are the things that today are still providing the right demand, the number of students are interested in. So that was the reevaluation. So from the beginning, it was always said that the idea was going to be a reallocation, right? That we were going to say, let's take some programs, and the Board of Education is the one that gets to help determine those decisions, working with their schools, that maybe there could be programs that are maybe outdated. There's not the same demand that there used to be. On the other hand, and I hear this from the University of Utah all the time, there are some highly, highly in-demand programs that they just can't, they cannot offer enough courses for them. So how do we make sure we're using those dollars the most efficiently and that will have the greatest impact for the state of Utah?
You know, I agree with the focusing on career-ready programs for our students to make sure our world's changing, technology's changing, jobs are changing, so we need to make sure we are training our students, right? I spoke with the president of Salt Lake Community College, and through this process, they have cut 26 different programs that did not have high enrollment, that were not relevant to getting students ready. That being said, you know, the U of U and other institutions, universities, are concerned with if the focus is on technical, does that mean that liberal arts programs, humanity programs, will also get cut then? And I think there's an argument to be said at a university level, we want all those different programs that enriches our lives, enriches our culture here. And so that was a big concern, if we're going to be focusing too much on technical and not letting our programs that are in arts and humanities thrive at the same time.
And maybe just to comment on that, I don't think that the intention was ever to cut those types of programs. I was a political philosophy undergrad, and I say that all the time. I use that degree more than anything, critical thinking, being able to make an argument, right? Those are critical programs. Those are the ones that I think are still going to be in high demand. They get you into law school. They provide other skill sets. So I think it's just looking and saying, are these the most needed versus maybe some that clearly are not having the enrollment that they've had before?
Well, I'm glad you're saying you're a philosophy professor, because that's a huge critical thinking is something that I think is getting harder and harder for some folks right now with social media and what's out there. We need more critical thinkers to be able to go out there and bring more value to our communities here.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to switch gears for just a moment on the judiciary. Mm-hmm. We talked about this on the program a little bit. Max, if we can get through a little bit of the, not necessarily the bill's content per se, but so many of them were proposed and so many of them stalled. At least there was a negotiation. They didn't go forward. Give us some context on that.
Well, and what we saw, this is, first of all, and I'll be interested in Representative Moss's perspective on this, but the things that precipitated these bills, as far as I understand it, are a series of decisions by the state Supreme Court, largely, that disagreed with the legislature on redistricting, on the initiative process, and on the education and the income tax going towards education. Those were all losses. The state legislature went to court, lost. And what seems like, and this is why I want this perspective, is it seems like these systems that are in place to make decisions, and sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. That's democracy and that's a court. You go in and someone wins and someone loses. It's just the nature of it. That you lose and so there must be something wrong with the court?
Yeah, I would say I wouldn't agree that was the defining reason. I think what happens is when there's an issue that becomes a high profile issue, members of our body are looking at that issue. And it starts to bring up other ideas and other approaches to things. I think that's what precipitated. Maybe that had the conversation going. When you look at some of these bills, for instance, 512, which didn't make it through, there was a lot of concern. And of course, this is the process that we have. It goes through a House, it goes through the Senate, it's got to go through the governor. That was one that was addressing a problem that I hear about all the time. I don't know who I'm voting for. I don't know anything about these judges. Is there a way that we can get some additional information? The way she started the bill is not where it ended, as you know. And so I think it created some of the discussion. I had one with the Supreme Court, right? Mm-hmm. And we were having a conversation saying, you know, the state's grown. We have more complex needs in the state. We've looked at other states that have also increased their Supreme Court numbers over the last few years. should we consider it? And sometimes you just open the conversation. So we open the conversation, but I get the timeliness maybe created that perception.
Well, and when you look at those issues, it's not so much, I mean, information, there's more information available on Utah judges than any state in the country. It is, I've done a whole lot of reporting on the judicial performance and all that that does. And let me say quickly that that this is where I have a little bit of a conflict of interest. My dad was a judge, and my dad was the chair of the Judicial Performance Evaluation Committee after he retired, and was largely was instrumental in setting up the evaluation process. Mm-hmm. But it's a process where every single voter can go online if they have their ballot at home. This is what I do: is I look up and I read everything about the judges. There are observers who have watched and evaluated how they do. There are lawyers who are anonymously surveyed about how these judges perform, and so there and largely what happens, like in most workplaces, a judge sees the writing on the wall when they're getting bad performance reviews. They're told what the review is, and if it's bad and it's likely that they're going to face a serious challenge, they quit before they have to face that.
Can I respond to that? Because I think you are appreciate the fact that you have a little more context. I will say every election cycle, I get inundated with questions around judges. So I don't think most people know there's a process. And some of those don't think, well, I give them whatever feedback I can, right? I've told them there's different things out there. But I think that that's been the discussion is, are there ways that we can get more information out? And I appreciate even some of our Democrats have raised the concern. Is there something else? Maybe this isn't the right bill. Is there other ways we can help solve this problem?
You know, if they are looking for ways to learn a little bit more about the judge they're voting in or keeping in, all we need to do as a state is inform them on how they can do that. There are resources out there already. I think the bigger issue here is our Utah Constitution is set up so that there are the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch that should all operate independently of each other and to keep everyone balanced and independent. That is the biggest part. What was concerning about all of these bills that was attacking the judicial branch is the legislative branch trying to influence and impact the judiciary branch. And that we cannot have that. We need to have that division of power and ability to have more of an impartial, independent voice when it comes to our judiciary.
Can I speak to this woman on that? I appreciate that. We actually have a constitutional right to do that. Most of these bills were within our constitutional responsibility. So when we talk about election of judges, when we talk about the number of Supreme Court justices, all of these things, we actually have that in our constitutional responsibility. So there is definitely clear delineation. We appreciate the separation of our branches, but there also is a role for the legislature to play.
I want to get to a couple of bills. One that's going to be in the has been in the paper, will continue to be in the paper, and it's related to the governor's power. The governor has 20 days after the session ends to sign, veto, or can also let a bill go into effect without his signature. So this is March 27th. It's coming up pretty quick. I want to talk about one of these bills that is on his desk right now. We've seen the governor veto bills in the past. It's not been a huge number. Last year, 7 vetoes. And then, you know, the 2023, no veto. So it's very curious. But I want to talk about this flag bill for just a moment, because this is one the governor is getting a lot of attention about. This is House Bill 77, Flag Display Amendments by Trevor Lee. Essentially, it says that only allowed flags, and that's designated here, can be displayed in government buildings. Representative, talk about this for a minute. Give us a little context on what this bill does and why the governor is getting some pressure to perhaps veto this bill.
So this bill makes it so that in classrooms or in any of the public schools, they cannot display any kind of flags that would show any kind of, I think he called it partisanship. Correct me if I'm wrong there, but
it has to get to a political statement. Things
unless there's an educational basis for the flag being displayed. You know, the concern here with this bill is for our LGBTQ plus communities when pride flags are not able to be displayed in classrooms. I had a lot of constituents, a lot of high school students reach out to me about this bill saying these flags, when they are displayed in our classrooms, it offers a safe space. It's a signaling to us that this is a safe place for us. When in a world where it's getting less and less safe and there's a lot more bills that are being ran that is obviously attacking this this community, that was a little bit safe place for some of our high school students here. And so the concern is when we are legislating inside the classroom to the extent of what bills, what signs, what posters can be displayed, that is concerning. But when you take a look back, I saw a report that said, you know, Sundance, we are the last three places that Sundance is considering and possibly leaving Park City here. Sundance brings $132 million to our GDP here in the state when it comes. When they look at these types of bills that are being ran here, it really makes them pause to think, do we want to come here? It creates 1,700 jobs in the state annually when Sundance comes. When we lost the outdoor retailers, that brought $40 to $45 million in revenue to the state, and we lost them for 4 years to Denver. When we almost lost the NBA All-Stars, that brought, I think, just shy of $300 million to the state. These types of bills that we're running have a real big impact, an economic impact on our state. So more than just a bill talking about should pride flags be displayed, it sends a bigger message to the nation when we do these things. When we talk about bills being vetoed, if the governor signs this bill into place, if we pass this bill, this is going to be one of the costliest bills we have to our state because of the economic impact that we can possibly lose by passing this bill.
Representative, let's get some context to this as well. So at the start of the bill saying you cannot do these flags, it says these are the allowed flags. It's not just schools, right? This is all government buildings is where this goes. And the allowed flags are things like flags of countries, states, universities, sports teams, Olympics. Yeah. All right. So those are the flags that are, instead of a list of all you can't, these are the ones that you can. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think the goal was to actually try to get the politics out of the classroom, whatever that flag is. You want to fly whatever the thing is, right? We've seen a lot of different flags over different things lately that people have been bringing into classrooms. We don't want any student to ever have to feel weird or different about something. They don't need to talk about their agendas, their politics, whatever that might be. Our whole focus is these are government funded. Let's keep the politics out. Whether it's a MAGA flag, a pride flag, whatever that is, we just think that let's focus on the flags that are the states or the governments that are not going to create division in our classroom.
I think one thing that it the message that is sent, and I think it's intentional, and so it's not necessarily a mistake. Is simply and what the message that Representative Nguyen, you're saying your constituents are hearing is that the pride flag is being defined as a partisan flag. That's probably true in Utah. That's probably when you look at the broad sweep of the Utah public, there are folks who think that a pride flag is a political statement about a subject that is up for debate, which is whether gay rights should be emphasized. And so I think that's what that states, is that that's the case. And then is that with the intention to send that message, that that our message is that a flag that's for gay rights is partisan?
Yeah, I think the focus where they went to is the right focus. Let's focus on the flags that we all agree on, the state flags, the national flags, the things that we all support, things that we all agree on. I don't think the classroom, especially K-12, that should be a topic that they need to even have a conversation about.
I don't agree on a BYU flag being in my mind. No, I'm kidding.
You can say that. I don't know. We're at the U right now, so maybe.
Yeah.
And where this bill extends it to city and government buildings too, that's a concern. You know, if we're saying we want to keep out of the classroom, but now telling other elected officials who are running municipal cities that what they can and can't do, what flags they can and cannot display, that's a concern.
And these are government buildings that are funded by taxpayers. That's why we're saying let's keep the politics out of government buildings.
Okay, we'll watch what happens with this one. I want to get to one more issue that is coming after the session. We're starting to talk a lot about referendums. Mm-hmm. All right, Max, let's start with you a little bit here, because there is a potential referendum happening out here on labor unions. Mm-hmm. This is the public sector labor union bill by Representative Jordan Tusher. So what they have to get is 140,748 signatures. That's 8% of all registered voters in Utah and 15 of the state's 29 counties. It's a high bar.
It's the highest bar in the country. There's no state that has a higher bar than that to get something on the ballot. It's likely that they'll succeed because we're talking about the teachers' unions and we're talking about public safety, largely fire and police. Those are the public unions that have some sway in Utah, and that there are a lot of them, and they're all over the state. So it's likely that they could get that done. It was an interesting process. That was by far the most controversial bill on the Hill this year, got the most attention. It's trying to see what is the problem that it's solving. And it seems like it really is a statement about believing that unions are just a negative influence. And that's what the legislature is saying, is that they don't believe that unions are productive. They don't believe that collective bargaining is a productive way to go about things. And so if that's the message, they sent it.
You know, Max, if I may jump in here, I saw that same report that you were talking about in terms of how many bills are passed and how much time we're dedicating to debate those bills on the floor. The HB 267, am I getting that right? The union bill had the most, our average debate time was 11 minutes per bill. Mm-hmm. That bill, the union bill, had over 100 minutes dedicated to debating on the floor. More so, when you say it's getting a lot of attention, we're getting national attention because of this bill. National unions are very concerned because right now it's just influencing the collective bargaining rights for public sector employees. Mm-hmm. The concern is what's going to stop there. That's going to go to private unions now, private sector, and start legislating policies around how they can start negotiating laws around union labors. So that's the concern. I think they will be able to pass this, the referendum, because we're getting attention on a national level, and they're going to pour all of their efforts and resources into Utah to make sure that we get those signatures that we need in order to protect the rights of our citizens to be able to collect bargain in unions, because we don't want it to go any further than HB 267.
Our last 20 seconds, Representative.
Last 20 seconds to answer that question? Well, first of all, I think that's a big leap to say we're going to jump to private. This is dealing with public unions. This is dealing with a very small group of districts and unions in the state of Utah. The ones that do collective bargaining is a small number. The problem you have is the majority of our state does not have, if you take the UEA, my area is 30%. You have 30% of the teachers that are members of that union that actually are having an input on that. We would like to see more voices. Doesn't say they can't, unions can still have the discussion, the debate, but we want to bring more people to the table, bring more voices to those processes of how they get paid, what their work environment looks like.
Deputy, last comment. Thank you for your insights.
Thank you for listening to the Hinckley Report. If you enjoy this podcast and want to help more people find out about it, please rate it and leave us a positive review.